It might not go down in the record books as the hottest summer ever, but we've certainly had to endure our fair share of sweltering days this year. And with more than a month before autumn begins, we may have to sweat our way through several more. Good morning, I'm George Boraki, and this is Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. This summer's heat may have given us something to gripe about, but it pales in comparison to what New Yorkers suffered through in August of 1896. A 10-day heat wave claimed the lives of more than 1,300 people in Manhattan alone. One local newspaper described the city as an inferno of brick and stone. Joining us now to talk about this largely forgotten natural disaster in U.S. history is Edward Cohn. He's the author of a new book called Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896 and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. Edward, good morning.
Morning, George.
All the way from Turkey you came.
That's right. I should get some kind of award, I think.
So you're living and you're teaching in Turkey.
That's right. I teach at a private English language university, Bill Kent University, and I've been there for 7 years now.
So then what makes you write about New York City in 1896?
Well, I've lived on and off in New York for about 10 years, and I started teaching a class on Theodore Roosevelt, and I started thinking about this Western cowboy mythology as I walked my Jack Russell Terrier along the East River thinking, how can anybody think that this man was essentially a cowboy? He was a New Yorker. And so during the heat wave, Theodore Roosevelt was police commissioner. And so the heat wave research comes directly out of my interest in Roosevelt and his early career in New York politics.
And he did rise to the occasion. He did things that saved lives.
Absolutely. He's actually one of the few city officials to do anything at a time when government officials at all level, federal, state, local, issue any responsibility for alleviating the plight of the poor. Roosevelt advocated giving away free ice to the poor of the Lower East Side. That might seem rather silly to us today, but that was the way you kept your food and milk from spoiling, especially during a 10-day heat wave. And there was an ice trust in the city that had priced ice out of range of many New Yorkers. And so Roosevelt advocated the city giving away free ice.
It's hard to imagine a time in New York City when it was so hard to get your hands on ice, especially today when refrigerators just make it.
Absolutely. The Ice Trust, a guy came down from New York, consolidated all the ice companies, jacked up the price. And so this was perhaps Roosevelt's first, you know, intimate contact with the real life effects of a trust. And this isn't just a twine trust or a steel trust, but an ice trust. And then by advocating giving away free ice, this was Roosevelt's first instance of trust busting 5 years before he becomes president.
In order to truly understand the magnitude of this natural disaster with some 1,500 people dying, as I mentioned, 1,300 in Manhattan alone, we really need to understand the housing situation and the climate in New York City in 1896.
That's right. It's not just that, well, they don't have air conditioning, well, they don't have electric refrigeration. In general, living and working conditions in 1896 are so different. I mean, most New Yorkers back then aren't stockbrokers and lawyers. They're manual laborers working 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. And so the average victim of this heat wave was a male, working age, otherwise healthy, manual laborer, probably an immigrant, living in the tenement. He would probably fall ill at work, stumble home, and in the early stages of heat stroke, and his neighbors would say, oh, well, there goes Seamus, drunk again. But he wasn't drunk. He was actually dying. He would climb the stairs to his suffocating tenement where the temperature could easily reach 120 degrees, like living inside a brick pizza oven, would collapse into bed, and the tenement itself would be the final nail in his coffin.
A lot of people tried to escape the heat by sleeping on their rooftops, and that proved deadly as well in the city.
Another aspect of the city doing absolutely nothing, one of the easiest things the city might have done was lift the ban on sleeping in parks. How many thousands of people might have headed to Central Park and been able to sleep and get a breath of fresh air and perhaps, you know, recoup some of their strength for the next day? The city did not do the simplest of things. They slept in the streets, they slept on the curbs, they slept on top of garbage bins, and as you say, many of them took to their fire escapes, to the rooftops with tragic results. Not just adults, but, you know, small children, 2 years old, falling five stories into concrete courtyards, at best breaking both their legs, lots of fatalities from that, as well as going down to the piers and sleeping in the piers, rolling off the pier and drowning. Some very bizarre, tragic deaths during the heat wave.
And on top of falling off the rooftop, some babies died on the roofs because rooftops suck in heat and maintain that heat. So it's still hot up there.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things that perhaps links a heat wave in 1896 to a heat wave today. The very architecture of cities absorbs, reflects, and radiates heat. And so you go up to the top of a black tar paper roof to try to get some sleep. And what's it doing all night long? It's just radiating all of this heat that's been trapped there all day long. And so it is as dangerous as being inside a tenement during the day.
A lot of people, of course, also fled to the waters around New York City, and a lot of people drowned, adding to the death toll during this 10-day heat wave.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the time of Coney Island. This is a very popular spot. Not everybody knows how to swim, though. This isn't a natural thing that people do. And so you have the case of people drowning off of Coney Island, drowning in the rivers. And even if they weren't drowning in the rivers, you know, one of the ways people did get some kind of relief from the heat was they had these floating baths in the river, something that's hard for us to imagine now. They're just wooden platforms where you end up swimming directly in the East River or Hudson River at a time when these are some of the most highly traveled commercial and industrial waterways of the world. Even if you didn't drown, the diseases and the parasites that, you know, the poor working class of the Lower East Side picked up from these absolutely contributed to disease and death.
In addition to Teddy Roosevelt, there was another hero during this heat wave, and that was the commissioner of the Public Works Department. He did a lot to help people.
Yeah, it's amazing. He emerged perhaps as a hero even before Roosevelt thought of doing anything. Right from the beginning, he experimented with changing the work hours for his men because he's doing public works. He's the guy who's responsible for fixing the streets in New York. And he continually did this when he realized that even in the afternoon, it was still hot. And if you think about if this had been copied by all city departments or even copied citywide, this would have saved lives. Another dramatic thing he came up with was flushing the streets, basically getting gangs of men hooking hoses up to the fire hydrants down in the tenement districts on the Lower East Side and turning the hose on the searing asphalt streets. And people at the time said, you know, you can almost feel the temperature coming down in the neighborhoods by several degrees.
Your book doesn't just tell us about these deaths. Your book really goes into a lot of detail about who these people were, their names, where they lived, and how they died. How did you go about doing that research?
The great treasure trove of information that I found was something so simple. It was the death certificates that are filed down in City Hall. And so I spent many days in front of the microform reader going through death certificate after death certificate. And as you say, they provide a wealth of information so you can really pinpoint who the victims are. You can tell what country they're from, thus whether they're immigrants, not just their address, but it says type of dwelling, tenement, basement tenement, rear tenement. As well, there is a spot for the doctor or coroner to hand write in information. And this is where you get some of the most, you know, strange circumstances of people's deaths. The baby who is born prematurely and end up dying, not because the baby has heat stroke, but because the mother, while she was pregnant, had heat stroke. You had doctors writing in the temperature of the body at the time of death, 109 degrees, 110 degrees, 111 degrees. It really gives you this kind of real world strong evidence about the torture that these people went through during the heat wave.
How did the people in the death business handle all of this, the coroners of New York City and the funeral industry?
They had enormous amounts of problems. The coroner's office was terribly overworked. The law at the time said that if the body wasn't under a doctor's care at the time of death, the coroner would actually have to go to that tenement, climb the stairs and inspect the body. And they just couldn't get to the hundreds and hundreds of victims. And so one of the last things that the coroner did was ask the mayor to lift the law for a time, saying that, you know, the family can't move the body until it's been checked because the body might be laying there in the steaming tenement for days. Coroner's clerks were overcome by heat stroke. There was a coffin shortage in the city. The coffin makers were working overtime, and coffin makers' employees suffered heat stroke as a result. There are traffic jams of the funeral processions trying to get across the river back to Brooklyn. And so you actually have hearses causing traffic to back up in the city. It is really almost a hell on earth scenario for these 10 days.
And it wasn't just humans being affected by this. Horses and dogs also, many, many of them died.
That's right. It's hard for us perhaps now in New York to think about a time when horses are the backbone of the city's transportation. If we look at the city streets, and perhaps if we think of every yellow taxi and bus as, a horse-drawn conveyance, personal carriages, carts for commercial transportation, above-ground horse-drawn trolleys are the main kind of public transportation. Normally, on a normal day, as many as perhaps 200 horses might die in a city street, and the city has a contractor whose job it is to travel around the city streets picking up dead horse carcasses, because if you're the horse owner, all you do is simply unharness your horse and you just leave it there in the street and you move on. Thousands upon thousands of horses, overheated, overworked, abused horses, died during the heat wave. The city contractor simply could not keep up with the demand, and so you have this whole new kind of flavor of pestilence now and a whole new health crisis in the city, because by the end of the heat wave, you had on almost every city block the carcass of a dead horse, lying on the searing asphalt, bloating and putrefying. Dogs, as you mentioned, there are a lot of stray dogs back in 19th century New York. And what do dogs do during a heat wave when they get hot? They salivate heavily. That looks like they're foaming at the mouth. When little boys are throwing rocks at them, they growl and they snap. And inevitably, somebody walking down the street would say, "Mad dog," at which point a policeman would have to, by law, come and dispatch the poor animal, usually by a bullet to the head. Unfortunately, in 1896, New York's police aren't very good shots, and so you would often have the display of a New York City policeman chasing a dog down the street, unloading his revolver at him with, passersby saying, "Hey, Mac, you should use both hands. You should rest the revolver on your arm." Dozens upon dozens of dogs were simply gunned down in the street during the heat wave.
We should point out that the heat wave began on August 4th, and it ended right about now on August 14th, but yet people were still dying.
Yeah, and this is part of the very strange and macabre effects of heat, that it lasts for days. I figured that perhaps the very last victim of the heat wave died as many as 8 days after being first struck by heat stroke. And I think this is exactly why people don't consider heat waves real disasters. They don't strike, and they don't leave property damage, and they don't leave a lot of good photographs and images. My book doesn't have any illustrations, because what does a photo of a heat wave look like? And I think about today, look at what the images of heat waves that we see on local media. It's children playing in fountains and eating ice cream. A heat wave means a holiday, when actually this is something, very, very dangerous, much more sinister.
Now, of course, you mentioned that the city really didn't do much to help besides the work of the Public Works Commissioner and Teddy Roosevelt, the head of the Board of Police Commissioners at the time. Did the media not hold government responsible in 1896?
That's right. This is decades before the New Deal, long before the Great Society. In 1896 is actually 3 years into a terrible economic depression that began in 1893, and there just aren't that many voices, including the press, including in politics at this time, calling for government involvement, government responsibility. And so all during this terrible economic crisis, long before the heat wave, from the president on down, government officials say, well, of course, this is laissez-faire government. We don't interfere in the economy. It's not our responsibility to help individuals, to give away food to the hungry, which is why when someone like Theodore Roosevelt actually champions this for 1896, is a fairly radical idea.
You have your book open there to a particular section. Can you read a little bit for us?
Sure. This is at the end of the heat wave when Roosevelt is personally supervising the ice distribution. And, you know, this is something that actually impressed me a lot, that he not only championed the idea, he personally supervised the distribution. And then afterwards, he actually went through some of the back alleys looking to see how, you know, the immigrant families used the ice. So just, you know, a short bit from the book. Roosevelt was right in the thick of things during the evening's distribution of ice. He made his rounds from station to station around the east side, including Eldridge Station, the precinct house for the neighborhood of the striking tailors. There, the police found it difficult to spread the 5 tons allotted them among the massive crowd of people gathered around the station. In less than half an hour, the entire amount had been distributed. If each person received on average 20-pound block, then approximately 500 people went away with ice. This represented only a tiny fraction of the residents of one of Manhattan's most densely packed tenement districts. Roosevelt was obviously moved by what he saw that night. In an August 15 letter to his sister, he recounted the strange and pathetic scenes when the ice was distributed. Such scenes would be repeated the following day as the ice giveaway reached 250 tons. Moreover, as Roosevelt had spent much of the heat wave out on Long Island, touring the Lower East Side that night while overseeing the ice distribution was his first opportunity to witness the suffering of New York's poor from the heat.
Were people critical, or are they today, of Roosevelt because he did spend a lot of time on Long Island and not in New York City?
Yeah, he was actually ill during much of the time. I mean, even upper-class Gramercy Park-born brownstone Roosevelt was feeling the effects from the ice. And, you know, having an estate on Long Island, even though you live and work in the city, was very natural. I mean, this is the time of cholera epidemics. I mean, you take your family out of the city during the summers exactly for these reasons. So, you know, absolutely, I think some people have said, well, Roosevelt wasn't even in the city for most of the heat wave. How can you refer to this as the making of Theodore Roosevelt? But my point isn't that this made Theodore Roosevelt's political career. This didn't put votes in his pocket and catapult him to the White House. This is the making of him, I believe, as the progressive president he's going to become and the dominant figure of the progressive era.
This was the making, perhaps, of Teddy Roosevelt, but this was the demise of the Democratic candidate for president in 1896, William Jennings Bryan, who was in New York City. He gave a speech, a very long speech, during a very hot night at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, Bryan wins the Democratic nomination in July with his famous Cross of Gold speech. He's perhaps one of the greatest orators in American history. But he's a Western populist. He's from west of the Mississippi, and he makes his career railing against the East, against the cities, against New York, which he openly calls in the press the enemy's country. And so the strategy is that he will officially accept the Democratic nomination in a massive rally in Madison Square Garden. And the hope is that if he can win over New York with another kind of Cross of Gold speech, with fantastic oration filled with biblical imagery, maybe he can win over skeptical New Yorkers, win over the cities, win the East, and thus win the presidency. Unfortunately for Bryan, he picks the height of the heat wave to give the speech to a packed house in Madison Square Garden, a place that the New York Times refers to as the most dangerous spot in America that night. And he chooses, again, a huge tactical blunder, to read the speech from a sheaf of papers. And of course, this is not what New Yorkers came to hear. They came for entertainment. They came to hear another Cross of Gold speech. And the effect was, with this incredibly massive heat, you have an emergency hospital actually set up in the basement of Madison Square Garden because they're expecting, you know, perhaps casualties during this speech. Within a few minutes of Bryan beginning to read this speech, thousands of New Yorkers simply leave the garden. The next day, even the most sympathetic Democratic papers around the country say this speech was an absolute failure. Bryan campaign managers forbid Bryan from taking a further campaign trip through New England and send him into seclusion to a private estate in upstate New York. He really loses the momentum of the campaign, and I can't think that there have been that many times in presidential politics in this country where there's been such a reversal of fortune within just a couple of hours.
The book is Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896 and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. It's out now from Basic Books. Edward Cohen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
When you hear the bells will ding a ring, all join round and sweetly you must sing. And when the birds and crew in the chorus all join in, there'll be a hot time.
You're tuned to Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. Good morning once again. I'm George Boraki. If you thought this summer was hot in New York City, brace yourself. Climate scientists at the City College of New York say more frequent, more intense heat waves are in store for the Big Apple. With us now is CCNY's Dr. Jorge Gonzalez. Dr. Gonzalez, good morning.
Thank you for having me here.
First of all, what kind of setup do you have at City College to conduct climate research?
We're part of a research center that is referred as the NOAA CREST Center. That stands for a Center for Excellence for Remote Sensing and the Environment. And it's a group of scientists and that incorporates about 20 professors and about almost 100 graduate students that are all working on climate sciences areas.
From what I understand, you have several hundred ground-based sensors and roof monitoring stations that collect temperature information?
Yes, so as part of our facilities, we have been organizing what we call the Urban Observatory. It's deploying a number of ground sensors across the city that incorporates typical weather information and also what we call vertical structure information. It's a unique number of sensors that are deploying the rooftop of some of the buildings across the city. And in all, we probably have more than 200 sensors.
We just got through what was the hottest July on record since July of 1999. And now you're telling us to get used to this kind of weather because it's going to get worse.
Well, this was a good opportunity for us to learn about extreme events, such as the one we had between July 3rd started all the way to July 7th. It was the first heat wave in more than 10 years. What we learned was fascinating. We learned about what will be the environmental behavior of the city under these extreme conditions. So things like what will happen in downtown over the heat wave in comparison to the surrounding areas, that was something that had not been observed before as far as we know. And that also allows to then learn about what will happen under this changing environment, if we can call that way, the changing climate, which the projections out of the different researchers groups and including ours is that there will be more frequent heat waves. And in places like New York, there may be perceived slightly more intense.
What is going to cause that to happen?
The heat waves are associated with high-pressure systems, and they are linked to the regional conditions that, in our case, are dominated by the ocean in summertime. So we have what we call the sea breeze events that they tend to cool the city for the most part. So our Atlantic oceans are warming slightly, as most oceanic waters, and the Atlantic is not an exception to that. So we may perceive some slight warming events more than usual with more frequency as we move on into this era of a warming environment. And those may be intensified in more coastal urban areas such as ours here.
We have a situation here in New York City, specifically in Manhattan, called the heat island effect. What exactly is the heat island effect?
Yeah, this is a phenomena that could be unrelated to a global changing climate. So what occurs is that when the landscape, the natural landscape, is modified to create a built environment, let's say a city, for example, that modification of the landscape, if it's significantly different from the natural, originally natural vegetated environment, meaning forests or green areas, then that will create a secondary source of heat now that is very localized. Now the heat will be stored in a slightly different way than it used to be. The trees tend to absorb heat in a significantly different way than the concrete, just to say that, for example. So now the city will store heat at a different rate. It will perceive the maximum temperatures hours after the forest area will perceive it, and will stay warmer for longer periods of time.
Your research shows that during the first heat wave we had this past July, that overnight temperatures ran 10 to 15 degrees higher in Manhattan than on Long Island or in western New Jersey, right?
Yeah, that is correct. And thanks to the very dense network observations that we have deployed across the city, we learned what will happen in this particular extreme event of a heat wave in the area of Metro New York and surrounding areas. And it was fascinating, the finding. So while the maximum temperatures were occurring somewhere between noon and 3 p.m., they were fairly uniform across the entire region as predicted by the National Weather Service. What we observed is that during nighttime, the surrounding areas, suburbans that have more green environment than the city, they actually cool during the heat wave about 10 to 15 degrees more than the city, which means that the city retained the heat. There was not enough time for the cycling of heating and cooling to be completed. So it was a tendency of continuous warming throughout the mostly downtown areas of Manhattan.
Would this also be true in the other boroughs, Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens?
We did not observe that phenomena as significant as in Manhattan. Brooklyn was partially observed. The Bronx have more green areas than the other boroughs, maybe comparable to Queens, some parts of Queens. So Brooklyn and Manhattan were the most intensified, and Manhattan was slightly more intensified than all the boroughs.
Let me ask you this question then. Is it much cooler in Central Park during a heat wave than it is in other parts of Manhattan where there are nothing but high-rise buildings?
Central Park is a clear example of what a green area within the city could do. And we observed about 10 degrees cooler than the rest of the city. So it was fascinating, very localized, cold spot that our observation were able to capture.
So Central Park is the place to be during a heat wave at night, huh?
If we can replicate some of that environment, I think that will provide a good relief.
My next question to you is going to be, what can the city do to help reduce these temperatures during such sweltering heat waves?
Yeah, this is a topic that we are intensively in researching at this moment, how to mitigate these potential frequent heat events in these very dense cities. And certainly greening the city will help tremendously. In places that are already built, maybe the solution will be to motivate green roof as much as possible. But also as we rebuild the cities, incorporating light materials, the materials that can store heat less intense as the typical century-old construction, I think that will certainly will help.
Can we learn from other areas, perhaps areas that are hot all the time, that already have these kinds of things in place, this kind of infrastructure that you're talking about?
Yes. After the heat wave of the year mid-1990s in Chicago, the city established a very aggressive program of greening the urban landscape. So I think Chicago is a city that we can learn a lot.
Dr. Jorge Gonzalez, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Jorge Gonzalez is a climate scientist at the City College of New York. And that's it for this week's Cityscape. I'm George Boldarchy. Remember, you can get past editions of Cityscape and learn how to podcast the show at WFUV.org. My thanks to senior producer Skylar Srivastava and producer Marlene Chin. Have a great weekend.